Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hello and welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Tomorrow marks the beginning of the Festival Albertine, an annual series where French and American authors, artists, and scholars talk about some of the most pressing issues facing our countries. It's produced by the Cultural Services of the French Embassy and Albertine Books. And joining me now are Hervé Farage, the Deputy Cultural Counselor of the French Embassy. Welcome.
Hello.
And this year's festival's curator, author, journalist, and activist, and New Yorker magazine contributor, Masha Gessen-Massa. Welcome as well.
Thank you.
Hervé, let me start with you. What is the history of this festival?
The festival started in 2014, so today tomorrow we'll start the fifth edition, and it's directly related to the story of the Albertine bookstore, because as soon as we launched the bookstore, we decided that we should create some kind of festival in connection with it. And the purpose of the festival was, from the very beginning, to create a conversation, a dialogue between French and American scholars, artists, thinkers in general, about topics which are relevant to the current world. So it started in 2014, and we are today, the day before the fifth edition. And also another important idea for us was to choose an American curator to build the program of the festival, because, as I said, we wanted to have a strong exchange of views between American and French thinkers. And on the American side, we had the feeling that it was much more efficient and interesting to give the possibility to a curator to craft the whole program, and then our role was to bring French speakers to the debates.
The theme is reimagining democracy. Why do you think that's important at this moment for both countries?
I think it's a very important theme nowadays. I mean, yesterday we had the results of the elections in Brazil, so it's also a way...
Hang in there, Masha. We'll talk about it in a minute.
I think we are really in the middle of the crisis, I would say, about related to democracy. In France, we had very passionate presidential elections 2 years ago. Mm. So if you look at the world everywhere, democracy is becoming an issue, something which has to be discussed. So that's the reason, basically, why we decided to ask Masha to curate this festival this year, because for us, at this moment, there is no more important issue than the future of democracy.
What do you hope comes out of these discussions at the end of the festival? What are some of your hopes for?
That's probably more a question for Masha.
Okay.
But I'm happy to answer it. I mean, we had the opportunity to work together over the past month, and I'm very interested in the fact that for Masha, the important point was reimagining democracy. It was not to look at democracy today, but to try to push forward an agenda of a democracy, a fully-fledged democracy with all the components of what can be the ideal democracy for our future. And I think it's a very positive way to put it. We are not going to complain about the current state of the world. We are going to try to imagine new ways to create a better democracy. And so at the end of the festival, I hope that people will leave the cultural services and Albertine bookstore with new ideas and in mind, maybe some hope to fight again for something which is strongly democratic in this world.
So it is active.
Yeah,
it comes active.
Definitely.
Remind people where they can go, and it's free to the public.
Yeah, it's a free event. It's better to RSVP on our website, the Albertine website. It's very easy. It's www.albertine.com, And yes, I mean, people can come whenever they want, and they can check the program on the website. Yep.
Hervé, thank you so much. Masha, let me bring you into the conversation. We hear about defending democracy, preserving democracy. Why go with the theme of reimagining democracy?
Well, I'm a professional hand-wringer about democracy, right? That's what I do twice a week on the New Yorker website. But when I was, and the festival is actually related to the topic of my next book. I'm writing a book on imaginative political projects. And the way that I came to that was that I sort of started out writing a hand-wringing book. And I realized that, first of all, I don't know what democracy is. And second of all, the way to protect democracy, I think, is to have a vision of the future, right, of the future of democracy. Especially because the threat to democracy right now comes from politicians who appeal to the imaginary past. And so the questions that we're asking are, you know, I mean, we don't know what democracy is. Democracy is always an ideal. Democracy is always an aspiration. It's always something that feels like it might be within reach. But then when we get there, we realize that there can be more democracy, right? There is never a perfect rule of the people, by the people, for the people. So I'll go ahead and answer the question of what I want to get out of it, which is that I want people to walk away thinking a bit differently, or at least knowing that there are ways to think differently about things that we tend to take for granted.
Why do you think people haven't been thinking about it differently? Are people just too married to historical narratives and mythologies?
I think there are reasons in the two cultures are probably different. I'd love to hear the French participants talk about it. I'm sure that will happen. I think in the United States, there's a very strong idea that as conceived, American democracy is just about perfect. And so we tend to focus a lot on protecting institutions as they are currently constituted and not think about a more perfect union.
In a story about the festival in the New York Times, you had this great quote that says, "We're not talking about how to salvage free and clear elections. I would much rather talk about whether elections are, in fact, a necessary and sufficient component of democracy." Why do you want to focus on the necessity of elections?
Well, that's actually just one example of many questions that I would like people to ask, right? But should we assume that democracy is best represented by elections? And what I mean by that is all sorts of things, right? I mean, I think if you stop somebody in the street and ask, you know, what is democracy, the person will give you some version of democracy is free and clear elections. Actually, there's nothing in the idea of rule of the people by the people that says that elections are the best way of getting there. You know, maybe random selection, the way we do with trial juries, is a better way of doing it. That's just one tiny example. You know, we're not going to spend 5 days talking about whether we need elections, but it's an example that, you know, often there are things that we assume that perhaps we shouldn't assume.
What are some of the other panels for folks who are thinking, wow, I really want to go engage with this festival?
Well, I'm very excited about a panel on the post-work world. So we're going to be obviously talking about what happens when most people don't need to work, or many people don't need to work. We're opening with a panel that's really, really personally important to me, which is a panel on borders. I really hope to see at least part of that panel talk about a world without borders, talk about the task, the work of imagining a world without borders.
You bring me to our conversations that are in the news today. I mean, obviously in France, they've had difficulties with the Calais, the jungle. I was saying, sharing that I was in Paris about a year ago, and I went to one of the new refugee camps that the Paris Parisian mayor had set up, which actually was so much better than anything that had been there previously. But clearly, they've been having a very difficult time dealing with the refugee crisis. And obviously, what we saw over the weekend in Pittsburgh, that the suspected shooter, the killer, Kenneth Bowers, he ranted online about the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, which obviously their whole mission is to welcome the stranger, protect the refugee. When this discussion that you're planning to have, what will be What will be the discussion of personal animosity towards the other? Let's get past the politics of it, just down to people deciding to hate other people.
Yeah, people are always deciding to hate other people. I mean, that's one of the easiest ways to sort of to find community, unfortunately. But I think that the problem that we have in an extreme political situation, which is what I think we have today, right, is we're constantly trying to fend off the immediate threats. And that's part of how a politician like Trump works. I'm very used to this from living in Russia for many years. Right, you're just dealing with the thing that needs to be fixed now, that needs to be saved now. And so, for example, when we talk about the so-called migrant caravan, where I actually have objections to the words both migrant and caravan, right? We don't even talk about the words that we're using because we're talking about Trump's threat to send the military to stop people from coming to the U.S. border. And so we're so many steps away, removed from asking the more basic question of why do we have that border? By what right do we police that border? Who appointed us the guardians of that border? Why is citizenship and residency, why are those rights, the only rights in the modern world that still stem from the fact of birth, right? We have given up all the other rights in democratic countries and mm-hmm. countries that think of themselves as democratic. We've given up all the other rights of birth, except for this particular one, right? Isn't it time we questioned it? And isn't it time we talked about how we inhabit this earth in the future? You know, this earth that we're also destabilizing and bespoiling in ways that create more displaced people.
We're speaking with Masha Gessen. She curated the forthcoming Festival Albertine, which will be happening October 30th through November 3rd at the Albertine Bookstore. It's interesting that you brought up the issue of people coming up to the United States looking for refuge, looking for safety, and the current administration's position on it and the way they're positioning it. I'm curious, as a journalist, is the media getting played in some ways by reporting on it and using the language that the administration uses? Or is this something that really needs coverage and deserves it?
You know, I mean, it's always a trap. It's always like a circular problem. It's like the problem of the Trumpian tweet.
Is that a Freudian slip?
Because, you know, there's like this really appealing idea, we don't report the tweets. We just ignore the tweets. But we can't ignore the tweets. He is the president of the United States. He is not going to disappear just because we pretend that he's gone away. In fact, that would be a very apolitical move to say we're not going to pay attention to what he says anymore. But then when you're reporting the tweets, you're immediately trapped into a situation where you're engaging with a vision of reality, and often a lie, that you shouldn't be engaging with. But you have to, because he's the president. It's circular, right? There's no good solution to it. But I think there are better solutions than other solutions. I think that solutions that don't have to do with racing to beat other media outlets are better solutions. I think that solutions that provide more context and a more thoughtful critique of not just a particular tweet, but the entire discourse are probably better solutions. We are in a constant situation of being trapped just by the fact of having this administration.
One of the things that was interesting, and you wrote about it in The New Yorker over the weekend regarding the Pittsburgh shooting, was the use of a social media platform that tolerates all kinds of speech, hateful, violent speech, that so many of people who believe those things have been pushed off of Twitter and off of Facebook. What's the answer to this idea, this places like Gab? I mean, is it, this is just an opinion question, is it better that all those people are in one place, or is it better to have them where we can see them?
Oh, you know, I'm a journalist, so it is not my job.
I know, but you're a smart person, which is why
I wanted to give answers. But I'm going to give this one a shot, right? And it has to do not with a solution, but how we talk about this. In this country, And in this way, the United States is unique, right? In this country, we are married to this fiction that we do not regulate speech. Right? In fact, we do regulate speech. You know this. You work on radio.
I've got seven words right here. I'm not allowed to say.
We regulate speech because we restrict pornography. We have movie ratings. We have all sorts of speech regulation. But we have this fiction that we don't regulate speech. So my suggestion is let's give up the fiction that we don't regulate speech. And let's have a discussion about what is and isn't acceptable in this society. This is a political conversation about how we live together. How we live together has a lot to do with what we say and what we don't say, and what kind of speech is acceptable, and what kind of speech is actually penalized in some way, right? There are many democracies that function certainly no worse than the United States that have explicit regulation and penalization of certain kinds of speech. And I think that's, you know, that's a major shift of framing that is required to have this conversation.
We're speaking with Masha Gessen. She is, of course, a columnist for The New Yorker, and she also curated the Festival Albertine, which is happening October 30th through November 3rd at the Albertine Bookstore in that beautiful mansion on the Upper East Side. The theme is reimagining democracy. Can we reimagine democracy without violence? Because people have fought for their democracy, yet people are violent in the name of democracy, their version of it.
Well, isn't the beautiful thing about the imagination that we can do anything we want? I have issues with sort of violent imaginings, including a lot of the revolutionary imaginary. So that's a fair question. And my answer is, I hope so.
As you're having the discussions on these panels, are there any panels that are talking about, I mentioned it earlier, France's difficulty in dealing with its immigration population? I mean, we focused on the United States a few moments ago, but will there be panels discussing that?
Well, every panel has both American and French participants. So we're starting out with the burning issue of the day and the future, which is rethinking borders. And there will be two French participants on that panel who I am sure are going to ground their discussion in the French conversation about it at the moment.
Some political analysts have suggested that the focus on the people coming up from Latin America and the discussion of the refugees is something that the current president of the United States and the other political leaders use to rally their base. Do you agree with that?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, Trump, like every autocrat of his type, right? Every autocrat who wants to mobilize people, right? I mean, he's a mobilizational type leader. He really wants people out in the street demonstrating their support for his mission. Right. And immigrants are, all those kinds of leaders use an other to mobilize the population. Immigrants are his other. Immigrants are the target of the day. Everything, all other targets that are pulled up sort of toward immigrants, I think, are kind of secondary in a way. So, of course, that's what's happening. The answer is not to not engage in that conversation. The answer is not to fall into the trap of talking about the conversation, talking about these issues in exactly the same way that Trump is, or just staking out a position sort of opposite him, using the same language and the same framing. I think the answer is to try to think about it differently, and really try to show that it is possible to think about it differently, because the silver lining, such as it is, which is very thin, but there is a very thin silver lining to a moment like the moment that we're living through, which is that it does open up an opportunity for talking about things because we see how unstable our current politics are, we see that there are real risks of losing things that we have taken for granted. And so that allows us to I think, reach for greater visions. And I think we're even seeing that in electoral politics right now. We're seeing that in the midterms. We're seeing different kinds of politicians
coming up
and inspiring people. And certainly the same thing has to be happening in the kind of public discussions that we're having at the festival.
On the flip side, what happened in Brazil? You have a big sigh when I mentioned it earlier.
It was just a generalized sigh. It was like, yes, that too. I mean, it's horrible, right? It's I don't know very much about Brazil, except that it was a society that just, from my vantage point, not that long ago, right? We were talking about all sorts of really exciting social reform that was happening there. Mm-hmm. And sort of the way that they were rethinking education and the way that they were rethinking some public works projects. I mean, it was like this inspiring moment. And so the sigh on my part was kind of like, okay, well, that's another potential beacon demolished. And somehow it seems that with every passing election, sort of the language that drives it just gets more virulent, more open. It's like that now we have this super community of hateful leaders in the world who are outdoing each other by showing just how horrible they can sound.
We're speaking with Masha Gessen. She's a columnist for The New Yorker, and she has also curated the Festival Albertine, which is taking place October 30th through November 3rd. Another big story, which obviously has bearing on democracy in the United States, is the Trump administration recently suggesting it was a memo that was leaked to the New York Times about erasing the idea of re-erasing transgender people. In a good functioning democracy, what should happen next?
I don't think that democracy is a set of mechanisms.
Right.
I think that democracy is a vision. So a good functioning democracy is not really the kind of phrasing that I would use, but
how would you phrase that? If you know what I'm trying to say is that after there is a statement like that from mm-hmm. From a leader that wants to put in place doing something like this to a group of people, if things are working in a way where people have representation and people have agency and they can activate, what in a perfect reimagined democracy would happen next?
Well, in a perfect reimagined democracy, we wouldn't have this power, right? No, I mean, we wouldn't have such power vested in such, you know, horribly flawed mechanisms. We have I'm blanking on the name of the guy who is now at the Health and Department of Health and Human Services, who is behind this effort to rewrite definitions of gender, who used to be at the head of the DeVos education project at the Heritage Foundation, right? So he's a far right activist who's trafficked in the idea of gender ideology. Gender ideology, and I've covered this a bit. I've been to some of these gatherings. Gender ideology is the specter of a Marxist conspiracy to basically eliminate categories of M and F in the entire world and make children lose gender by the time they graduate from school. That's kind of the imagination that is offered. It is it's something that is pronounced, that phrase, gender ideology, as something mm-hmm. that is terribly frightening and a threat to the existing order of things. Right. So we wouldn't have that in government. We just wouldn't have that because it's crazy. It's nutty. It's paranoid. It's a conspiracy. We wouldn't in a democracy that was anywhere near functional. We wouldn't be dealing with this issue. But since we are dealing with this issue, I think we have to understand that there is something particular about, on the one hand, the appeal of reversing very recent and very rapid social change, and that's of course why transgender people are so much a target of this administration mm-hmm. because it's easy political capital. You say, okay, that makes you uncomfortable. I'm going to take that away. I'm going to make it disappear. And we also have to understand, and I think this is a little trickier, but also very important, that there's something very particularly bad about taking rights away. Right? I mean, ideally, we would like everybody to have had rights already. But there is a particular violence to rights that have been gained, right, that we didn't have and then we had and now are taken away. It does have real violent consequences mm-hmm. for people, including, you know, leaving people exposed because they don't have a closet to go back into.
It was Roger Severino.
Roger Severino, thank
That's
you.
It is. Before I let you go, you know, you get a million invitations to do a million things, please come curate this, please come speak here, please come do this.
Oh, I lead such a glamorous life.
You
yes.
do. Why was this important to do? Why did you find this as an attractive? Why was this a yes for you, this festival?
Oh, I think this is an extraordinary opportunity because I really think that what we're doing is we're creating this kind of five-day lab. Right. So for me, it's a research project as much as anything else. It's not a performance project. Mm-hmm. I think that I really want to walk away from every panel thinking thoughts that I haven't thought before. And I think that we've created a program that allows for that opportunity.
And your next book will come out when?
That is a terrible question to ask an author, especially when their editor might hear.
Sooner rather than later, we hope. Masha Gessen, thank you so much. The Festival Albertine is happening at the Albertine Bookstore October 30th through November 3rd. Events are free. You can go online to find out. And also, it will be live streaming as well. Masha, thank you so much for joining us on All of It. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, October 29th, marks the sixth anniversary of Superstorm Sandy hitting our area. It started as a hurricane on 10/27 and then pummeled this area 2 days later. The storm devastated communities, caused widespread flooding and multiple deaths, incurred tens of billions of dollars in damage. Many attribute the widespread devastation to the storm caused to do ill-preparedness for that type of weather event. Many attribute the ferocity of the storm to climate change. So today we want to bring you two conversations where we look at the intersection of art and climate change. First, a piece from the Brooklyn Academy of Music's New Wave Festival. It's titled Falling Out. The Phantom Limbs Company's co-founder, Jessica Grindstaff. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
And Eric Santo. Hi, Eric. They use marionette puppetry and multimedia set design in their newest piece to look at the impact of the 2011 tsunami and Fukushima nuclear disaster. It's a third installment of a trilogy that looks at different aspects of climate change. Falling Out comes to BAM from November 7th to the 10th. So glad to have both of you in studio.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having us.
So Jessica, this is a final installment of a trilogy. What's the arc of the trilogy?
Well, the first piece we started working on in 2007, and it started from a staging idea that Eric had. Do you want to say what your...
Oh, yeah. As a marionette enthusiast, I was always trying to find new ways to present marionettes to people. So I had this idea of putting the marionette operators on stilts so that the puppets could walk around freely. Needless to say, that was a bit of a challenge, but we soldiered on. We got some amazing people who were willing to try it out.
And we imagined this idea both in a white space, and I had been wanting to make a puppet or a set piece of a ship, and we joined together and realized that the story we should tell is that of Ernest Shackleton and the Endurance Expedition. And as we started to research that, we found out there was a grant in which you could go to Antarctica for a project, and as we were filling out the grant, it was talking about the broader impacts of the work that you were doing, and we both kind of thought, why is it important to retell this story? And we were looking for a modern context, and we ended up getting the grant. And when we went to Antarctica, we were working with many scientists involved with climate change and became really passionate about the subject at that point. So that was sort of the launching into a trilogy that was about people's relationship to the environment and climate.
Two things. One, I misspoke. It's the Next Wave Festival. And secondly, not a lot of people get to say, well, when I went to Antarctica.
Yeah, that's true.
What was that experience like? And as you took it in, what part of your brain was thinking, oh, I can make art from this and I'm going to figure out what to do with this information, this research, which just can be so scientific and clinical.
Mm. Right.
Well, I was going as the composer for our company and also the puppet maker, but as composer, I was going making sound recordings and field recordings of both natural sounds and also man-made sounds there, which would be folded into the score. And Jessie is the set designer as well as the director in our company, so she was documenting the light and landscape. So we just had a bunch of things, more or less, and then data. And then it was just the experience of being there was so incredibly humbling based on the enormity and of the landscape.
It was kind of like being on the moon. And there was sometimes you didn't know when you were looking because there was nothing relatable for scale. So you didn't know if you were looking at ice or sky or water or something that was 50 miles away or 500 miles away. And so it really did make you feel quite small, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. The landscape there is at once extremely fragile and also incredibly aggressive, needless to say.
An epic.
Epic, yeah. Monumental, and tiny.
As as I mentioned, it was a trilogy, and this is the third part, Falling Out. How do you describe or define this piece? I don't even want to try. I want you to do it.
Well, this piece is about the Fukushima Daiichi, the tsunami in 2011, the earthquake in 2011, mm-hmm. followed by the tsunami, followed by the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown. It is, in the true sense of the word, an absolute disaster, and it continues to be a disaster to this day. So Eric and I are both big fans of Butoh dance, and we knew we wanted the last piece to be about water, and so we talked about looking at having Butoh and puppetry meet, and maybe finding a language to talk about this disaster and the continuing crisis in Japan. So we contacted Dai Matsuoka, who's a dancer with Senkaijuku, and asked him if he would be interested, and nervously made a little meeting with him after one of his performances at BAM. And he actually was very excited to explore this with us. That was about about 3 years ago. And so since then, we've been looking at how to combine those dance forms along with flex dance, which is a street dance that started in Brooklyn between 10, 12 years ago. And flex dance has a very kind of liquid feel to it, and also a bit stop motion. And we thought creating these intersections to tell a nonverbal story that really taps into emotion for people would be an interesting thing to do. So we've been doing that. And the story in the show actually really just kind of goes through some of the personal stories of the people that I met when I went to Japan and Fukushima. And we've used those as sort of anchors for the storytelling. And we show some of their loss, but we also have worked really hard to capture the hope that I found in that region. As we end this trilogy, that became increasingly important to me, because without any sense of hope, why are we all sitting and having this conversation, and why are we getting out of bed each day? So that's kind of, I don't know if that actually describes what the piece is about, but it's highly visual, multimedia, a lot of really powerful collaborators coming together to look at the stories within the disaster of 2011.
We're speaking with Jessica Grindstaff and Eric Sanko about their piece Falling Out, which is coming to BAM November 7th through 10th as part of the Next Wave Festival. Eric, so you mentioned flex dancing, Jessica, and you explained it. Could you explain what Butoh dancing is and how the flex dancing and the Butoh dancing work?
I'll try. I'm not a Butoh expert, but it's a thing that we've always been attracted to, in that its origins are start in the early 50s. And it was kind of in response to the sort of more romantic kind of dance that was prevalent at the time in Japan. And it's also informed by the results of the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And it's very typically very slow. It focuses a lot on entropy and decay and anguish. Yeah. And what?
And death.
And death, yeah. And similarly, strangely, there's a kind of a great area where Butoh and puppetry overlap, because as a puppet enthusiast, we often think of the puppet as a sort of a husk or something, or an empty vessel that you will to be alive. And in Butoh, they think of the body as material and as a thing, and that you also you're the agent of its animation.
Let me ask you about. Oh, go ahead, Jess.
I was just going to say, and then flex dance is very immediate and kind of raw. It's not something that's often set. It's not choreographed. And I think that both the flex dancer that we initially were working with and our Butoh master found a lot of overlap in the way that the body is grounded, and the way in which the body is really used as this kind of this vessel. And for example, in the show, we tried for a long time to figure out how we were going to represent the tsunami, and we came up with all of these different very large epic ideas. But of course, it's a tsunami, and we're in a theater, and there are the restrictions of that. And so it always sort of felt, it lost me when I would watch it. And so we said to our flex dancer, what if the tsunami was just in your body? Like, what if we went and we got really intimate with it and we just watched it sort of travel through your muscles? And a flex dancer can do that. which is quite...
I can visualize
it's,
it. Yeah.
It's quite incredible to watch. And I think it, again, I think it helps people to really feel the disaster more than view it as something that you sort of saw on a news channel 11 years ago. Mm. And once you see it in a body, you can sort of feel it in your own body in a way. And and maybe I'm happy to hear that you started the segment about Sandy, because these tragedies are all interconnected. Obviously, an earthquake and a storm are different things, but there are natural disasters happening all over the world right now, and we need to be able to feel that.
Mm. Eric, you composed the music for the piece.
Yes.
What were you hoping to convey with sort of minimalistic tones?
Well, one thing, a kind of a basic tenet that we have about the puppetry and that I try to employ with the writing the music is that rather than to try to mimic an emotional condition, we try to actually describe it, to portray it. So in other words, if we ask the puppeteers to talk, if I say we're going to talk about despair as an example, we don't want to show a puppet mimetically showing what it looks like to be an unhappy person. But what does the actual emotional state of despair look like? And similarly with the music, I try to do the same thing, because it would be very easy, for example, because the story is based in Japan, to identify it with Japanese traditional instruments. That's a little bit on the nose.
A little too on the nose.
A little bit on the button. And it kind of doesn't give the audience any kind of way in, except you literally are telling them where you are. So in other words, similarly, I try to identify emotional states and think, what do they sound like? Not what does a person experiencing that sound like? So I hope that doesn't sound too egg-headed or complicated.
Not complicated, at all. So just, I also want to ask you about the staging. There are plastic bags on stage. There's two pieces of material I want to ask you about. The plastic bags and then the tulle.
Okay.
Like the squishy, you know, the sort of wrinkly things you see on ballet,
yes,
tutus.
Exactly, crinoline or tulle, yeah. So the crinoline, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to represent radiation and how to represent water and wind and elements. And one afternoon while I was in the design process, which means that I was just thinking about it for grants in the back of my head, I was sitting with my daughter in the living room and the window was open and one of her tutus started to blow across the floor, and it had, obviously, it was really ghostly and kind of beautiful image. And when I saw that material, I knew that I wanted to work with that. And so I filled out a grant saying, this is what I'm going to use, and it's going to be amazing, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I went onto Facebook after I finished the grant and saw that my friend had just done an installation. Christine Schuele is a visual artist, and she had just done an installation with 2,000 yards of tulle. And I said, what are you doing with that tulle? And she said, you should come and see. I'm projecting on it. It's amazing. It was. And then she said, well, afterwards, when I'm done, you can have it, and if you help me deinstall it. So Eric went, and he helped to deinstall it. And they shoved it all into probably 50, 60 black trash bags, which then ended up in my studio. And I showed up at my studio and felt really annoyed that there was this big pile of black garbage bags. And we were about to have a residency on Governor's Island through the LMCC space grant. And I was thinking of how we were going to start our improvisations. And I just thought, well, we'll just start the improvisations with removing the material, and we'll see where we get with that. And I was telling one of our Japanese dancers who was going to be involved, Takemi, this is how we were going to start. And she said, do you know about the bags in Japan? And this is quite early on in the project. And I said, no, tell me. And she said, they're taking the top 18 inches of topsoil all over northern Tohoku, and they're putting it into these giant black bags. And it's called cleaning. And then they are stacking them and making these giant installations the size of several football fields, of which there are hundreds all over northern Japan. And they're leaving them there and kind of creating these new landscapes that no one knows what they'll do with them. And so auspicious, shocking, upsetting.
Creepy.
I mean, all these things. And I have to say, so I knew this, and we started working with these bags, and they and I always like to think of our set as being like a puppet. And so they are very active on the stage, moving all around, and they're a part of the storytelling. But then I actually went to Japan and confronted these landscapes of bags, and it was
they're ominous.
Even more shocking in reality. Yeah.
Before I let you go, you've mentioned marionettes and puppetry and how much and how important they are to you and meaningful. What do the puppets symbolize in this piece for you?
That's a good question. They kind of vacillate between a couple of different things. We thought of them as being, I guess, ultimately as being perhaps the spirits of people who have moved on. What else would you say, Jess?
I think they're primarily in the piece, they've come to represent memory. So we use them for people to sort of relive the memories of people that they've lost. So they're kind of a husk that holds the soul of a memory. That's how they feel to me now.
Yeah. And the puppets are great at coaxing emotion out of people because they're
so
vulnerable.
And empathy, which is what we're really looking to
to
tap into this time. Mm.
The name of the piece is Falling Out. It is at BAM, November 7th through 10th, as part of the Next Wave Festival. Jessica Grindstaff and Eric Sanko, thank you so much for joining us on All of It. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
Coming up next on All of It, we continue our theme of artwork and climate change. This time, it's a public art piece you may have seen from the highway. Stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Our next guest is also making work around the theme of climate change. And what was left unsaid by our previous guest's work is made explicit in artist Justin Bryce Gariglia's new project. Gariglia has created a multi-sided exhibit across all five boroughs, comprised of solar-powered highway message boards titled Climate Signals. It's presented by the Climate Museum, which has been temporarily housed on Governor's Island in partnership with the Mayor's Office of Climate Policy and Programs. And it runs through November 6th. Happy that Justin Bryce Gariglia is able to join us to discuss the project. Welcome to All of It, Justin.
Hi, Allison. Thank you for having me.
So how did this project come to be part of the Climate Museum effort?
Well, originally it started out as a phone call with a philosopher named Timothy Morton. And Tim is one of the top ecological philosophers, eco-philosophers working in the world today. And he's down at Rice University, and he wrote a book called Hyperobjects, which I had been reading and thinking, oh, this really lined up, aligned with some of the things that I was thinking about. And hyperobjects are the notion that that there are things around us that live in temporal and spatial scales that are non-human, so we have a difficult time kind of understanding them. And so I called Tim and I said, Tim, I have this crazy idea. You're able to write in such a pithy manner that communicates these important ecological issues so well that could you help me and could you write some aphorisms for me that I could use in some of my art projects? And so Tim started writing these pieces for me, and I started trying to weave them into a project, and suddenly I realized that they should not be on a piece of art. They should actually be out in the public. And I was driving down a highway one day and looking out the window, and I saw this highway sign that was flashing and, you know, warning me about what was coming down the, you know, down the road. And I said, that was it. That's how we need to communicate some of these they're very like, kind of haiku-like bits of text. So that's kind of where the project originated from. And then the Climate Museum and the Mayor's Office approached me to do this project around the city when they saw the original piece that I did, which is currently still up at Storm King Art Center, which has been up there in their climate change show.
So it's sort of interesting. I want people to understand that these look like actual highway signs.
They are actually, yes. They're called solar-powered LED highway message boards. That's their technical title. And these are the exact same machines that you see parked on the side of the highway or on roads, warning you about construction or, you know, what's coming up on the road ahead. But they also have a certain like officiality to them because they're often you know, they're almost always connected to kind of the public, you know, public space and public areas and where you see the government possibly doing work and being active. So
the New York City Parks Department chose 10 sites to specifically highlight areas of the city vulnerable to climate change. Did you tailor your messages to each site or neighborhood?
So we have one set of aphorisms, and that set is translated into different languages based on the demographics of the different areas. So in the Rockaways, the sign flashes in English and Russian, and I think we also have Chinese on that sign. If you go into Queens, the Queens sign has Chinese and English. And I think there might also be French on that sign. So all the every sign is programmed slightly differently, but the aphorisms are the same, but we start bridging into different languages to really have a more broad impact to reach all the different demographics that we possibly can with such a limited installation.
I don't want you to give them all away because I want people to go see them and find them, but can you share a few of the aphorisms?
Sure. So the series that we have up has, actually, I don't have them in front of me. I have about 60 of these aphorisms that I have on the wall here, and I don't have the ones marked that we have in the New York City show.
You can share some of them.
Come back to me in a minute, and I can pull those up for you so I don't read the wrong one.
Well, you also, something that's interesting, we're speaking with Justin Bryce Gariglia about his, the creator of Climate Signals. It's presented by the Climate Museum, and it runs through November 6th. They've also had a series of, let's kind of call them civic engagements at the exhibit, community engagements. What's been happening there?
So that's been, the person who heads up the Climate Museum is Miranda Massey, and she, you know, this is her idea. This is a brainchild. She's an absolute force of nature, and she's put together this incredible amount of programming around the signs. So the idea was, how do we really engage the local community, not just have the signs up there, but how do we really get people in the community to understand what this is about and to actually reach out to them? And so several weeks ago, there was Ask a Scientist Day. So you could have gone to any one of the signs in the five boroughs, and there was a scientist, at least one scientist, staffed at every single sign. And we had quite a few of them were from NASA. This was actually organized by somebody from NASA who was able to pull all these scientists together. So it was really quite unique, in terms of the outreach. It's really something special. So,
well, I've got a couple of the signs. One says climate change at work, which is great and sort of funny as well. Abolish colonialism.
Yes. So, and then fossil fueling inequality is another one that we have. Vote ecologically. So, these signs were essentially working with three lines. So as you know, haikus are typically three lines. So these are kind of like mini haikus that were getting out there. Alt facts end now is another one. Human agenda ahead is one of my favorites. And in general, what we're trying to do is get people to think about climate change and about the impacts and just trying to get this message out into the public realm. One of the big problems that, as many of the activists will tell you, and people that are really engaged in the climate conversation, is that it's not talked about enough. It's very easy to ignore and not pay attention to. So one of the main roles of this project was really just to get this into people's minds and get people thinking about and engaging with these ideas. And one of the things that I've noticed being out by the signs is that when people walk by, they intuitively read what's being flashed up on the sign, and often they're saying it out loud. And what's happening is that tends to start a conversation. So if people are walking together with their family or friends, somebody will inevitably repeat out loud one of the slogans, and it'll start a conversation. And that's what this project is really about, getting people to have this conversation, this very, very important conversation. You know, our response to the ecological crisis today, to climate change, to the sixth extinction, this is the moral imperative of our time. This is absolutely urgent. It's so urgent. But it's so easy to just sweep under the rug and kind of ignore, because it's not... We don't have to deal with it unless you're a NASA scientist, or unless you're a farmer, or unless you're an Inuit. You're not able to really see this or engage with this problem on a daily basis to the point where it makes you want to act. And so the idea is, we need to get more and more people connected to and thinking about these issues. So and that's what this project really is about.
Quick question in the next 20 seconds. Are you both an artist and an activist?
That's a good question. I'm a human. I'm really interested in how humans are going to be able to survive going forward. These ecological ideas have really become the cornerstone of the work that I've been doing recently. So,
Justin Bryce Gariglia, creator of Climate Signals, has an event tonight at NYU. Thank you so much for joining us on All of It.